Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
A few times before, of course, but he was here late last year before the change in leadership, and he gave an important talk on education, essentially, which was widely reported. So it's great to have him back. I'll introduce him briefly. He graduated in honours in both law and arts from Melbourne University. He worked as a political staffer. He became the State Secretary of the Federated Clerks Union in Victoria. He's also an author of a number of books, the member for Melbourne since 1993, a figure in the Shadow Ministry since 1996 in a number of important portfolios, finishing up as Shadow Minister for Finance, and of course since the election of the Rudd government, the Minister for Finance and Deregulation. And the Minister's going to speak for us tonight on business deregulation. Lindsay Tanner, many thanks.
Thank you very much, Jared, and can I first thank the Sydney Institute, which does an outstanding job for public debate in Australia. It's really a very important organisation, and I appreciate the opportunity, particularly in opposition, when it's not easy to get a hearing sometimes, to be able to get a serious audience and a serious platform for discussion, and I certainly hope to be able to continue to do that, and I'm sure my colleagues do in government. The Rudd government has inherited an economy in which underlying inflation is running at 3.6%, the highest inflation rate that Australia has seen for 16 years. Australian businesses and home buyers, of course, have had 11 interest rate increases in a row. The Reserve Bank warned the previous government on 20 occasions, I was present at some of them, about capacity constraints in the economy caused by infrastructure and skills deficits, and the risks posed by inflation as a result of these deficits. Yet little was done by the Liberals to address these issues. At the same time, Commonwealth government spending has been accelerating at an unsustainable rate. Fiscal policy has actually been contributing to inflationary pressures when it should have been constraining them. This is really the Liberals' economic legacy. John Howard and his government were always only focused on the short term. They spent money only to stay in office. They lacked the ideas and the discipline to do the things required to set Australia up for the next 10 years, the next 20 years. The Rudd Labor government intends to be different. We have a different approach. Our focus is on the long-term task of reducing inflationary pressures and improving Australia's productive capacity. And productivity is at the heart of the Rudd government's economic agenda for Australia. It's obviously at the heart of our education revolution and our commitment to remove infrastructure bottlenecks. It's at the heart of our determination to restore spending discipline so we can refocus the budget on the things that will count, that will really matter for Australia's future. Improving productivity is also at the heart of what I want to talk to you about this evening, our deregulation agenda. Like a smouldering fire, the Liberals let the deregulation agenda in this country lie dormant for most of their 11 years in office. I intend to reignite it, relieving businesses and consumers of the burden of inappropriate, ineffective or unnecessary regulation will build Australia's productive capacity and create a stronger economy. The Rudd government is putting deregulation at the heart of our economic agenda for the future. And I am particularly delighted to be addressing you tonight as Australia's first Commonwealth Minister for Deregulation, making my first major speech on the deregulation subject. Kevin Rudd promised before the election that we would have a deregulation minister in the Cabinet, and as he promised, we now have a Cabinet Minister with specific responsibility for deregulation. This really matters. You won't see much deregulation when no one's responsible for delivering it. You need a finance minister as guardian of fiscal discipline, and a deregulation minister as guardian of regulatory efficiency. The two roles fit very naturally together, and I'm delighted to have both of them. We've already, notwithstanding the workload issues that inevitably follow, we've already started to review and reform existing regulation, adopting practical measures to relieve the regulatory burden. Procedures will be strengthened to ensure new regulation is enacted only where absolutely necessary and at minimum cost to businesses and to consumers. Most importantly, I intend to introduce a culture of continuous improvement in regulatory activity, a culture in which government's always looking for opportunities to streamline regulatory processes, to form more productive relationships with citizens, organisations and businesses affected by regulation, to actively seek out and to respond to ideas for improvement. Well-designed and targeted regulation is essential to fostering competitive businesses and protecting the community. Copyright laws, patent laws, facilitate innovation by allowing people who create and invest in research to reap the benefits of their work for a period before the new knowledge is made available to all. Limited liability and legal incorporation are essential to risk-taking economic activity. Regulations such as these enhance productivity. They enhance our economy. So we shouldn't think that in some way regulation is a bad thing. Regulation is a good thing. Bad regulation is a bad thing. Regulations are important to a well-functioning, productive economy. Some regulations necessary to minimise the anti-competitive abuse of monopoly power. A very intrusive regulatory regime may impose serious burdens on a dominant supplier of essential services, but without it, business and consumers would face higher prices, poorer services, and less innovation. Other regulation, of course, can be designed to protect producer interests. Businesses who are fortunate enough to be inside the regulatory tent don't complain about the regulatory burden because it helps them keep prospective competitors at bay. But other businesses and consumers, of course, pay the price. My target, and the government's target, is regulation that's outdated, excessively burdensome on business, or unfair to consumers. And frankly, examples are not too difficult to find. The 2006 Task Force on Reducing Regulatory Burdens on Business, led by Productivity Commission head Gary Banks, identified many. One of my favourites was that governing product labels prescribed by the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority. Hands up those who've heard of the Australian Pesticides and Veterinary Medicines Authority. Hey, there's a couple of those. Very good to see. It's an important organisation. This particular regulation requires a business to lodge a special application, a new application for approval for it, a label to a product, to make any change to the standard product label, even if the only thing that's changing on the label is the shade of the colour on the label. So if you have gone through a corporate rebranding and your standard corporate colour is now pale green instead of dark pink, and you want to change all the labels on your products to reflect that, then under the chemicals and veterinary chemicals rules, you've got to go through the whole approval process for your label over and over again. Reasonable if you're changing the ingredients, potentially dangerous, potentially life-threatening ingredients, and people have got to be informed of that. Pretty absurd when all you're changing is the colour shading on the label. The cost of regulation is notoriously difficult to estimate. Spread across a large number of businesses, it often goes unnoticed, even though the aggregate burden can be quite substantial. The Productivity Commission's best estimate of the total cost of compliance associated with all federal, state, territory and local government regulations could be as high as about 4% of GDP, which is over $40 billion a year. As well as imposing specific compliance costs, regulation can also have a choking effect on entrepreneurship, risk-taking and innovation. And these costs ultimately affect us all through higher prices and a more restricted choice of goods and services. So deregulation, done properly, will improve the capacity of Australian businesses to compete, to innovate, and particularly to compete internationally, not by engaging in some kind of race to the bottom, but by catching up to other OECD countries that have already put in place advanced regulatory reform programs to assist business. Charities and other non-profit organisations also face costs in complying with regulations that reduce resources available for the provision of services to the community. Now, I'm sure many of you are thinking none of this is particularly new. Political rhetoric about this problem has been in abundant supply, let's face it, over the past 10 or 15 years. What is new is that we, the incoming government, recognise the need for deregulation to be an ongoing feature of our government if the burden of red tape is going to be effectively tackled. Not just an occasional sporadic burst of activity, but an ongoing, continuous effort. Achieving genuine deregulation requires continuous attention, not spasmodic effort. Kevin Rudd has given me ministerial responsibility for the government's deregulation reform program. The Banks Review recommended giving a cabinet minister this role. The former government didn't respond to this recommendation. I've also got a minister assisting me on deregulation, Dr. Craig Emerson, who I'm working very closely with. Since we took office, Dr. Emerson and I have been getting to work on reforming existing regulation. We are working with the states and territories through the Council of Australian Governments, or COAG, as it's known colloquially, to address areas of regulatory duplication or inconsistency between different levels of government. Our Business Regulation and Competition Working Group has been meeting to progress an accelerated program of reform, which will be presented to COAG in late March. We had the second of three preliminary meetings this morning in Sydney. We're making significant progress. And to be fair to the previous government, the initial steps in this project were put in place by COAG in April last year. But what was missing was drive. What was missing was urgency. What was missing was the political will to keep pushing, because if that's not there, then it's very easy for these things to trickle off into bureaucratic cul-de-sacs and you end up with years going by and very little being achieved. The measures we're pursuing will be targeted at reducing the cost of regulation to business. For example, the Standard Business Reporting Initiative will allow businesses to submit BAS statements, state tax returns, ASIC documents, ABS survey responses through a simpler, faster and easier process using their own record-keeping software. Streamlined environmental assessment processes will stop the time-wasting process of two groups of environmental assessors looking at the same information and holding up approval processes. Nationally consistent occupational health and safety laws will allow multi-state employers to roll out the same training and safety programs across all work sites. In addition to this effort at the state and territory level that we are driving, we will be revisiting the recommendations of the Banks Review that I've already referred to. The Banks Review made over 170 recommendations. Many of these have not yet been implemented, including the regulation of labelling of agricultural and veterinary chemicals, surprisingly enough. We wanted to, and I should add that if you actually want to change that label, the fee is, I think from memory, about $600. So there's a price to changing the colour of your corporate branding if you're in the agricultural and veterinary chemicals business. We want to turn these recommendations from a worthy piece of research by the Banks Committee into real outcomes for business. The Productivity Commission will also conduct regular reviews of the regulatory burden on in individual sectors of the economy. And the government's response to the Commission's 2007 report into the regulatory burden in the primary sector will be delivered as soon as possible, and I'll be the driving force in putting together that response. Agriculture Minister Tony Burke has already announced the deregulation of the single desk arrangements for wheat exports. Always puzzled me why we got rid of compulsory unionism for workers but kept it for wheat farmers. Well, we have deregulated the single desk arrangements, and this reform has been politically tough, but it's the right policy for Australia. Growers will benefit from competition between accredited exporters, and that'll put downward pressure on export supply chain costs. Accreditation standards will ensure that the reputation of Australian wheat exporters, so badly tarnished by the wheat for weapons scandal, is rebuilt and protected into the future. Transport Minister Anthony Albanese has concluded a bilateral open skies agreement with the United States, which will benefit Australian consumers and businesses, both with more competition flying between here and the United States, but also more opportunities for Australian airlines within the United States. Both of these decisions proved too hard for the Liberals, who like to call themselves the party of small government, the party of letting the market rule, and the party of getting out of the road of business. A systematic approach to identify and reform regulations across other areas of government has begun. Over the coming months, I'll be working in partnership with other Commonwealth portfolio ministers to identify and address areas where the regulatory burden on business can be eased. The process will work like this. I will initiate proposals for reform, and when the line minister, the portfolio minister, sees what a sensible proposition that is and agrees, then together, in joint partnership, we will work on a reform agenda to deregulate a particular sector of government regulatory activity. Now, the first instalment of this is already underway, and it's also a fulfilment of an election promise, and that is comprehensive reform of the Financial Services Reform Act. We're reforming the reform, and in particular the disclosure regime, which has caused significant problems for many businesses in this country. We've all heard the stories about the 50 pages and 80 pages disclosure documents. The Business Council of Australia even cited an example in its submission to the Banks Review of 227 pages of documentation being given to a customer wishing to open a simple cheque account with an overdraft limit and a home loan. I doubt whether the customer actually read the 227 pages. This stuff, of course, benefits neither business nor the customer. It increases costs, which the customer ultimately pays. Minister for Superannuation and Corporate Law Nick Sherry and I have recently announced the formation of the Financial Services Reform Working Group to solve this problem, and the first roundtable discussion with the key interested players in the industry is going to occur in this city at the end of this week. Now, there's serious work to be done in our own backyard as well. There's a fair amount of red tape internally within government, and although much of it won't necessarily connect with the activities of private businesses, ultimately everybody pays for it in some form or other. Reporting and regulatory requirements are essential to the proper functioning of government, but unnecessary red tape in the bureaucracy is simply a waste of public money. A review of internal red tape conducted by the Department of Finance and Deregulation has identified a number of areas where bureaucratic processes should be improved, and some changes have already happened. Reporting arrangements for foreign exchange transactions have already been streamlined, and the electronic OzTender system was introduced to improve government procurement reporting, but there's more work to be done on this front. In that area in particular, we've now got three reporting mechanisms, partly as a result of the Senate imposing obligations for reporting, perfectly reasonably. We need to rationalise these systems into a single, highly transparent reporting mechanism. These kind of reforms are targeted at reducing and reforming existing regulation, both within the Commonwealth and, of course, externally. But that's only half the job. We also need to ensure that there is no net increase in the regulatory burden as a result of new Commonwealth regulation. Prior to the election, we committed to a one-in, one-out principle for new regulation. When ministers bring forward new regulatory proposals, they'll be required to also identify other areas where regulation can be modified or removed to reduce compliance costs for business. This form of regulatory budgeting will address the cumulative burden of regulation. A common starting date for regulations would also give greater predictability and certainty to business. We're currently analysing the pattern of starting dates across all areas of legislation. There's some obvious exceptions where urgency is required. If there's a clear need to reform a particular civil aviation safety regulation, for example, and failing to reform it creates an unsafe situation, and it would clearly be absurd to wait 9 months until July 1 or whatever to do that. But in general, the idea of rationalised starting dates makes a lot of sense, and we believe that significant improvements can be made. The Office of Best Practice Regulation, possibly another government body many of you may not have heard of, has moved into the Department of Finance and Deregulation, reflecting its central role in improving the quality of regulation. The OBPR will continue to administer the best practice regulation principles, that's what it has been doing for some time, and be a regulatory watchdog on government departments, agencies and ministers. Regulatory proposals will not come to Cabinet unless the OBPR agrees that an adequate regulatory impact analysis has occurred. In all but exceptional circumstances, a regulatory impact statement and the Office of Best Practice Regulation assessment of its adequacy will be made public before regulations come into effect. That's not a requirement at the moment. That's an additional strengthening of the system that we're putting in place. Where a regulatory proposal has been exempted from the regulatory impact statement process, a post-implementation review of its effects will be conducted, and the Office of Best Practice Regulation will publicly release its assessment of that review. That's also not a requirement at the moment, but we are putting in place that strengthening of existing arrangements. Now, I'll shortly be making a statement to the Parliament confirming the government's commitment to the independence of the Office of Best Practice Regulation. It's moving from an arm's length body, statutory body, the Productivity Commission, to being part of my department. But in order to maintain its integrity and the independence of its processes, we're going to put in place protocols that ensure that I and other ministers can't interfere with its operations, can't seek to influence its decisions or recommendations regarding the best practice regulation requirements. The OBPR will, of course, continue to report annually on the level of compliance with the regulatory impact statement process across all government agencies. This is something it's already doing. It will continue to do that. All of these things represent, in aggregate, a serious and significant reform program for the government. But the biggest challenge, in my view, is to establish an entrenched culture of continuous regulatory improvement and reform. We cannot afford to lapse back into the era of spasmodic effort interspersed with very long periods of lassitude. It's not just about what we regulate, but also how we deal with business and the community in administering regulation. For virtually a decade now, I've been arguing that globalisation and technological change have fundamentally altered the role of government in modern Western societies. The old model of command and control is giving way to a new model where government acts more as a facilitator. Rather than simply mandating rules, an effective government must now act in many respects as an intermediary between different interests in the community. Time and again we hear business saying that government has to keep talking to business about how regulation affects business. That's something that I am deeply committed to doing. Just a few examples of where the new government is actually living this out in practice. Consultation papers are already out on the new national employment standards, the design and regulation of our first home saver accounts, importantly, the implementation of a carbon emissions reporting scheme, and proposed amendments to the export cargo legislative framework. These discussion papers, these consultation mechanisms, have already been released. The Assistant Treasurer, Chris Bowen, has established a tax design review panel to examine how to reduce delays and improve the quality of tax law changes. In the coming months, I intend to convene an informal group, consultation group of senior business leaders who will help to alert the government to emerging issues and opportunities for further deregulation and provide feedback on reform implementation. In addition to this, Dr. Emerson and I are also finalising details for a small business advisory council, which will be consulted on regulatory proposals affecting small business, and its primary role will be to contribute to the regulatory impact statement process and ensure that small businesses are properly consulted. The people on the committee will not themselves be directly dealing with the fine print of the civil aviation safety regulations necessarily, but they will be responsible for ensuring that the kind of businesses who are directly affected will be adequately consulted. Now, a key to our success in advancing this agenda will be our ability, our capacity to be open with the community and to facilitate compliance rather than just waiting to punish breaches. Even small changes to practice, even small changes, can make a big difference. Regulators should work with industry to identify improvements to regulatory practices, and I want to build to encourage the creation of a culture of continuous regulatory improvement in the same way that manufacturers, or the better manufacturers, seek to continuously refine production processes. And that means a key role for the people who work under those regulatory arrangements. As US diplomat and economist Chester Bowles once remarked, government is too big and too important to be left up to politicians. So we need to engage the people who are directly involved in these processes as we move forward and as we make decisions and choices about regulation. Now, in order to pursue this, I have asked leading economist Nicholas Gruen to work with me on these issues. He's championed the application of continuous improvement and total quality management themes to regulation. Why can't we use technology to bring frontline regulators and the regulated together to improve regulation? In the UK, the Better Regulation Executive, which is part of the Department for Business, Enterprise and Regulatory Reform, coordinates work across government to reduce regulation. So far, 19 UK government departments and agencies have implemented over 280 initiatives to tackle red tape. These reforms are estimated to have saved British businesses and non-profit organisations more than £800 million a year. Part of the UK system involves a modern-day version of the suggestion box, a website where businesses, community organisations and individuals can submit an idea for cutting red tape with a public response from the government required within 90 days. Innovative ideas like this, which harness technology and allow people to better communicate with governments, should be embraced. Perhaps, though, we can go even further. What about incorporating into individual regulatory regimes a simple way for people to give feedback or suggestions at the same time as they are filling in online forms? Sure, the old suggestion box in the corner of the factory was often left abandoned, covered in cobwebs, because management didn't really treat it seriously. But in this case, the people carrying the regulatory burden, the people whose time and money is being absorbed by excessive regulatory imposts, they've got a strong incentive to alleviate that. They just lack the easy means to do anything about it. The average small business owner doesn't even have the time to participate in an industry association, let alone pursue a campaign for regulatory reform. They're too busy just surviving, just making a dollar, just keeping their business ticking over. I want to break down the barriers that impede progress, that impede regulatory reform. Why on earth has it taken us so long to tackle the excesses of the financial services reform disclosure regime? Why has it taken us so long? Regulators should be directly and continuously subject to feedback from business. Again, not occasional spasmodic outbursts, but continuously. We shouldn't need more banks reviews, or for those of you who've got long memories early in the Howard government, the Bell Review. We shouldn't need more banks reviews and Bell Reviews, because the operation of our own regulatory system should be telling us, day in, day out, where the problems actually are. Over the coming months, we'll be talking to regulators, business, consumers and community groups about how we change that culture of regulation. We are serious about change. I understand, better than many, that business wants certainty and stability, and that there is always a high premium on change because there is always a cost to change. So I'm not seeking endless change for change's sake, but that's no reason to allow excessive and unnecessary regulatory burdens to remain in place indefinitely. So while we have to be conscious of businesses' need for predictability and security, that's a particularly important part of the landscape here, we've got to ensure that we are always seeking to improve our regulatory arrangements. My task as Australia's first National Minister for Deregulation is an exciting and fairly challenging one. There is much to be done. Reducing the regulatory burden is critical to improving the efficiency and productivity of the Australian economy. It's a very important element in our continuing battle against inflation. A very important element. And in general, Australians are pretty good regulators. Yes, we have problems. Yes, we need to improve. But there's many countries around the world that would not stand much of a comparison with us. Our can-do attitude is a very powerful factor that keeps regulators honest. But we've tended to rest on our laurels in recent years after the great advances, particularly in the 1980s and to some degree into the early 1990s. We've tended to rest on our laurels. We can't afford to do that. We can't afford to sit back and say, oh, wasn't it great? We did good things 15 years ago. Our government intends to do better. The Rudd government is absolutely committed to deliver continuous improvement. We're committed to improving how all governments in Australia collectively regulate. We're committed to improving how we regulate. We're committed to improving how we regulate ourselves internally. We're committed to ensuring that the burden on business, on economic activity, and ultimately on all citizens and consumers is kept to the absolute minimum, and that the regulatory arrangements that are in place in this country are the good regulatory arrangements that produce good outcomes, that protect citizens, that enhance economic activity, that produce the outcomes they're designed to do with a minimum cost burden. We're committed to achieving that continuous improvement, and it's my job as Minister to ensure that we deliver. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Minister. Now, there are a couple of seats up the front, and you shouldn't be shy. If you want a seat, just come up and grab one for those standing at the back. But I know it's like church, and you'll stay down there. Or school or something. So we come to questions and discussion. Thanks to Mellisons for the use of this fine facility. And can I just lead off? I'm sure that there would be a lot of people in business, including in small business, who would welcome what you've said tonight, pretty well all of what you said tonight. But can I just raise one issue about regulation, which is not quite within your portfolio, but is not far away from it. I think in the small business community there would be concern about a degree of re-regulation in relation to unfair dismissal laws, which, and you've pointed out yourself, that what upsets business is that small business is very busy, it doesn't have time to do a lot of things, it can't join organisations, and it can't go down to legal tribunals on a regular basis. How are you going to ward off the re-regulation in unfair dismissal laws against your general deregulation stance?
In a former life, I had an extensive experience with unfair dismissal laws. In fact, the Victorian unfair dismissal laws in the 1980s as a union official. And they actually worked reasonably well and had a fairly modest burden on business because they were very informal. They didn't involve lawyers. They were pretty streamlined. And broadly speaking, it was only the relatively unusual and seriously outrageous case that produced really negative consequences for an employer. Although some of the fine details, of course, are yet to be determined, and I'm not the direct minister involved, and I have a role in these things, I think the key objective that we'll be pursuing is the most user-friendly system for all concerned, both prospective applicants and also respondents, which means minimising the extent to which you've got the involvement of lawyers, of large costs, and of the threat of large costs. The big problem that emerged from the federal system that we put in place in 1993 was the ability for prospective applicants to threaten their former employers with legal costs. That so-called go-away money emerged from that, so eliminating that, I think, is crucial. Like anything else, there's always a balance to be maintained in these things. I think the architecture of our policy has got that balance right, and obviously the proof of the pudding will be in the eating, but I think the mechanism that we'll put in place will deliver fairness for employees, but at the minimal burden or prospective burden for businesses. That's a very important balance to get. We didn't get that balance right in 1993. The Howard government didn't fix it. They tried to fix virtually everything else, but they didn't fix the problem that had been created. We are certainly committed to fixing that problem and getting a fair system that's fair to everybody, not just the people who are applying for redress.
Thanks, Rob Fergus.
You've talked about deregulation, but you've also talked about red tape. And from the sound, on balance, I thought the speech was more about red tape than deregulation, mainly because there's not a political consensus for the sort of deregulation we saw in the 80s. So I wonder if you're gilding the lily a bit. You did mention the wheat board and the single desk. That's what I call genuine deregulation. You mentioned airlines. Singapore Airlines, those sort of issues, that could be an area for genuine deregulation, but I wonder if it's more the minister for cutting red tape.
Many would see the two, although technically speaking they're probably overlapping concepts, and there are some definitional discussions that we could have here. Many would see the two as coterminous, but you make an important distinction. I think it's important for me to be conscious of the limitations of my responsibilities, so that read extremely widely, I'd be in charge of three quarters of government, which would probably be very interesting, but some other people might have some things to say about that. So I think it is important to bear in mind that those big picture questions about how do we regulate transport or communications or whatever are still always going to be ultimately the responsibility of the ministers in charge of those things. And having been Shadow Minister for Transport, having been Shadow Minister for Communications, I know only too well just how big and complicated and challenging those issues can be. Now, I would expect to play a role in those debates, and I think anybody who's followed my public pronouncements over the years would have a pretty good idea of where my biases lie. Having been a strong advocate for deregulation in a number of areas, for example, broadcasting, so I would expect to make a significant contribution to the collective government decision-making on those issues. But there's no getting around the fact that when you've got a big systemic question to deal with, you need to have the line minister primarily driving it. The thing that will be different, and it's similar to my role as finance minister, I will not be making the micro spending decisions in the health portfolio. Clearly, those are issues for the health minister, but I will be there as a source of pressure, as in varying degrees previous health ministers have been, to minimise waste, to maximise efficiency, to get the best value for money from that portfolio and from that minister. So it's a similar role where there are both specific responsibilities and diffuse responsibilities. So even though I will not be in charge of deregulating Australia's aviation sector, or whatever the theoretical proposition might be, I will be a voice in the decision-making process with a specific responsibility for pursuing those general imperatives, in the same way that in budget discussions, my responsibility is to be a voice for minimising expenditure and maximising the efficiency of outputs and the achievement of outcomes.
Mr. Turner, you mentioned earlier you mentioned the figure of akin to 10% of GDP as being
four.
The cost of regulation up until recently.
Four. That was the
word. I'm wondering whether you have a target or at best a best guess as to the extent to which you are going to be able to reduce that by, say, the end of the first term of a Rudd government?
The answer is no. And one of the things that I'm possibly slightly emotionally influenced by is that I'm not a big fan of targets. I'm a fan of doing things. One of the things we've seen over recent times is the use of targets like the Howard government's 1996 promise to cut red tape by 50%. Now, no doubt that sounded pretty good to people at the time. not quite sure what happened to the delivery. So I'm conscious of the fact that in this area there has been a well-trodden path of rhetoric and targets as promised targets as a substitute for achievement. So the focus I'm pursuing is let's actually just roll our sleeves up and start doing some things and put ourselves in a position where in 3 years' time or 2.5 years' time, we'll be judged on what we've achieved. And I'm very conscious of that. And this is the lifting of the bar that Kevin Rudd's done. Because by, in effect, creating not just a cabinet minister but also a minister assisting, we are going to be judged in slightly less than 3 years' time about what we've done. And I think that's the right thing to do. So we could tie ourselves in knots creating, whether it's percentage targets or arithmetic targets or whatever. Frankly, I'm not that interested in targets. I would like you and anybody else who's interested to assess what I and the government have done in 2 or 3 years' time on the content. So, for example, financial services reform. Did we fix the problem? And if we did, how beneficial do we think that's been for both the financial services sector and consumers generally? They're the tests that I'd like to be exposed to. I think targets are all too susceptible to manipulation, to spin, and they, in a sense, become the political commitment. They often don't mean that much. In some circumstances, in other areas, they have an important role to play as a discipline. In this area, I'd rather just do things.
David, Noel.
Minister, you talked at some length about continuous improvement. And continuous improvement in the service sector always depends upon quality, giving people incentives to improve, rewarding initiative. It's regrettable, but quality, incentives and initiative are not the bywords of the public sector. How will you go about creating the incentives for the public sector to simplify, be clear and also demonstrate what they have improved?
You don't represent a state government by any chance, do you? Sorry, that's an in-joke. We have been grappling with the questions of regulatory reform and harmonisation and the need to revisit the national competition model with incentives and with the states. And broadly at that level, that's a concept that I think has stood the test of time as a reasonable proposition. This problem you refer to is one that I'm accustomed to dealing with because exactly the same thing applies with savings. If I, as the finance minister, go to a particular line minister and say, look, we think if we did things a bit differently in this particular area of your portfolio, we'd save $10 million a year, then as things stand, there is no particular incentive other than the overall benefit of the government and the community. There's no particular incentive for that minister to say, right, let's get to it. This is the chronic dilemma of finance ministers because, of course, if you go the other way and say, look, we'll find the money for you, but you get to spend it, then that can be kind of self-defeating. So you've hit on a bit of a challenge. There's no question about that. And I think partly the answer and the position we've adopted in the segment of our activities that's most pertinent to, that's our own regulatory activities, is this joint exercise where I go to an individual portfolio minister and say, I want to pursue a regulatory reform project for the following area, financial services, and if the individual minister resists, then there are greater powers than either of us who have to ultimately determine whether or not these things should proceed. If the individual minister agrees, we can then set to work and pursue the outcomes. I think the correct answer to your question, to the extent there is one, is that you've got to deal with these things on a case-by-case basis because each situation is unique, each has its own characteristics, and the incentives or the perverse incentives for a minister to resist reform or a department or an agency to resist reform will vary considerably from instance to instance. But nonetheless, you make an entirely valid point. which I'm very conscious of because I experienced exactly the same problem in my finance minister role.
There's a question down there, then we come up here.
Minister, I've got a question regarding regulation of the power generation industry, and I'd like to put a hypothetical to you. If your Minister for Climate Change came to you and said, I want to reduce carbon emissions, and I want domestic households to be little entrepreneurs and have windmills and solar panels on their roofs, and can we agree a feed-in tariff, which might cause some consternation at state level? What would your thoughts on something like that be?
I am aware of the feed-in tariff concept, and there are countries like Germany, I think, which have developed particular arrangements in this regard. I should add that I also did a bit of exploring a year or two ago about the prospect of putting a mini windmill on my own house. God, it was difficult. The cost and mucking around and so forth, it was... I admit I gave up. So there are some significant questions there that they're ultimately for both the Minister for Climate Change, the government generally, but other ministers, the Minister for Minerals and Energy, Energy and Resources, not Rex Connor, the Minister for Energy and Resources, Martin Ferguson. They are issues that obviously they are the primary drivers of. I'd have to say, though, that my responsibility I don't see as being the person who's there to insert more regulation, in the same way that I'm not there to show people how to spend more government money. In my capacity as a Member of Parliament, and in some respects in my capacity as an ordinary Cabinet Minister, I have to express views and take a position on issues like that and a whole heap of other things, and from time to time I do have to separate myself from my portfolio responsibilities, but ultimately, if I'm the Minister for Deregulation, then my primary standpoint has got to be in addressing any of these questions, minimising the regulatory impact of proposed changes on business and on consumers. So that'll be my responsibility, to insert that perspective into debate, whether it's that kind of proposition or any other.
Minister, you've talked a lot about dismantling unnecessary Commonwealth regulation. What about duplication in Commonwealth state regulation, where that exists?
There's two, or at least two, major efforts going on in that regard at the moment, one of which is the one I referred to earlier, the Business Regulation and Competition Working Group. I haven't got the acronym memorised yet, I'll get around to that, of COAG, which I co-chair, which is focused primarily on harmonisation, things like the classic, that probably the most important one, is occupational health and safety laws, to get a harmonised health and safety regime across the nation, but there's a fairly lengthy and growing list of areas we're tackling. The other area, which I suspect probably is more directly related to the sentiment in your question, is the negotiations occurring with respect to specific purpose payments, covering health, education, housing, all of those kinds of things. And what has happened over the years has been gradual Commonwealth intrusion into state areas of responsibility tacked on to handovers of payments. Now, the area where this got to a particular level of absurdity under the Howard government was in school education. The most extreme example of this was the famous flagpoles initiative, where school funding became conditional on schools having a flagpole. Now, and there are numerous other examples of this. Now, irrespective of your view about whether schools should be required to have a flagpole, it really is absurd that you've got state governments owning, running, managing state school systems, but the Commonwealth, as part of the process of providing some of the funding for those systems, micro-regulating through that funding process. Now, where we are headed and the negotiations on specific purpose payments, and this is still a work in progress, of course, is to drastically reduce the number of different agreements and to build them around a different concept, which is more or less a base of funding and with incentive or performance-related additional payments. Certainly my view is, and I think the general view in the government is, that we don't want to end up micro-regulating the administration of public hospitals or state schools or whatever. Our general view is that the Commonwealth's focus should be on outcomes, not inputs. So rather than micro-regulating the inputs to the process, to the extent that we want to create conditionality on the handover of money, it should connect with outcomes rather than flagpoles or shade cloths or whatever the case might be.
I'm going to move first thing, and we'll go here and then have a brief on this question down the back.
During deregulation, to what extent is the legal system involved? Because I could imagine that sometimes they are not involved. In other cases, they would be, because you have to change or modify a formal law.
That's an extremely good point, and one of the particularly challenging things that we face in the financial services reform area. That and this is a challenge that I think in many respects goes beyond my remit, although it's an important part of what I have to do, because it goes to government as a whole, state governments and so on. That is the ever-growing litigiousness of our society and the capacity of very clever lawyers, which I used to be one many, many years ago. Well, I was a lawyer, I'm not sure. Yeah. I'll leave it up to my clients to judge how clever I was. The capacity of very clever lawyers to exploit regulatory arrangements in order to produce outcomes that governments didn't intend, and then in turn governments have to and companies have to respond to protect themselves. That's been a key driver in the 80-page documentation phenomenon with financial services reform, is financial services providers seeking to protect themselves against every conceivable legal eventuality, no matter how absurd. So this is a very significant part of the challenge, and I think it's actually something that we as a society need to have a big collective think about, this whole question of how individual rights are intermediated within these regulatory regimes, because and how we actually regulate and what role lawyers play. I've already talked about the unfair dismissals arrangement, where having been both a lawyer and a union official and a member of a government, I've seen that challenge from a number of different angles. And much as at one level it might look like a good idea to have your full-blown legal rights being pursued by Joe Bloggs QC, in the wider scheme of things, it's not a good idea. Now, whether that applies to other regulatory activities, other rights and whatever is always a matter for debate, but this question of the interface between the legal system, lawyers on the one hand, and regulatory arrangements and individual rights on the other is a very vexing and challenging question that I doubt if I'll be the person to solve or resolve, but it is sitting there on a whole lot of fronts in our society, and there is no correct answer, but there is an issue.
Rory's got his hand up. Okay, it's got to be brief, Rory.
Sorry, I'm going on for too long.
No, you're fine.
Minister Tanner, my question is to you with your finance hat on. Last year, all of us, rich or poor, were allowed to put up to $1 million into our super accounts. And Treasurer Costello's subsequent removal of taxes on super for those over 60 probably was the biggest free kick to the wealthy in the history of Australia. The cost of superannuation concessions each year runs into the tens of billions of dollars. It's rising fast. and it's heavily biased towards the well-off. The benefits are heavily biased towards well-off. My question, as finance minister, you and your razor gang are looking to fix the hole that Treasurer Costello punched into the integrity of the Australian tax system, or a further change to super simply too hard politically?
We're actually going to have Rory to speak next week. I think he's after a budget tip.
Yep. Have you got any difficult questions for me by any chance, have you, Rory? Look, there is actually a straightforward answer to that question. I won't debate the analysis of the reforms that were put forward, but even to the more jaundiced eye, of which there are a few around, there were some significant positives in the reforms that the former government put forward in superannuation that you refer to that were announced in the 06 budget and then implemented last year. But the key thing is that we committed to honour those reforms, and it's something that I think people should note, and this applies to tax cuts, it applies to a whole range of things, that there's always a variety of opinions on big issues of this kind in public life, and there's always a lot of alibis available for ratting on your promises should you seek to do that. Thus far, and I anticipate into the future, the position we've taken is that we have made a commitment, we're going to honour it. Now, that makes my life a little bit tougher as Finance Minister, because the scope of operations kind of gets narrowed a bit, but I think it's the correct call.
Question. There's one question
here, I think. Is there something down the back or not? Okay, that's it, and then we've got a question over here. I think we've got
to finish. Okay,
just give it there. Yeah. It's going to be brief, okay?
Minister, congratulations
on you and your party's recent victory.
Thank you.
My question is just simply, the Australian dollar is pretty steady and strong at 90 cents US, for example. Well, how will deregulation affect that standing or strength in any way?
You as a punter now.
Yeah, that's right. Should I advise you whether to buy or sell Aussie dollars? Look, I doubt it. And as I've commented recently, there are swings and roundabouts with the current strength of the Australian dollar. But there's another important dimension to this which I think we often tend to overlook, and that is the Australian dollar's level is not just a product of Australian factors. It's amazing how we tend to look at that, and particularly when we look at it against the US dollar, when in fact the trade weighted index is probably a more important and more significant indicator. We look at it against the US dollar, we forget that a fairly big proportion of the recent fluctuations or the recent rise in the value of the Australian dollar are in fact a story about what's happening to the US dollar, not a story about what's happening to the Australian dollar. So by definition, it is unlikely that however successful I am in deregulatory efforts, that will have much of an impact on the fortunes of the US dollar, much as I might like otherwise. So I think the honest answer is pretty unlikely. But it's part of a wider picture where the classical thing in economics, of course, is everything's connected to everything else, and you twiddle with a knob over here and something happens over there. So I suspect it will be part of a mix which, you know, will influence other economic phenomena, but I suspect any influence on the value of the Australian dollar will be decidedly indirect and decidedly modest.
Time for two very quick questions down the back and then over here.
Minister, James Flynn from Dow Jones. You've argued today that reduced business regulation will be part of the government's fight on inflation, yet the government is marching towards cutting income tax quite substantially in the next budget. People like former Reserve Bank Governor Bernie Fraser...
Yeah, we don't have a lot of time.
Okay, there's a...
I've seen his comments.
...queue of people now arguing against the income tax cuts. You're about to... Reserve Bank said 4% CPI in the first quarter. Malcolm Eady said that last week. How is it that the tax cuts are a good idea?
There's a number of things I'd remind everybody of here. First, a number of commentators don't appear to have grasped the fact that the tax cuts don't all hit the Australian economy on July 1. So the total value of the tax cuts for the 08-09 year is not suddenly carpet bombed on the Australian economy on July 1. It is progressively rolled out over the year, of course. So to the extent that there's a stimulatory impact at a given point in time, it's actually far less than some people have been presenting. Secondly, the tax cuts do have a significant impact on participation, on reducing effective marginal tax rates, which is an important part of improving the overall productivity of the economy, and in particular the longer-term challenges we face with the ageing of the population. Thirdly, I would suggest that you have a think about the knock-on consequences of the absence of the tax cuts. Now, trade unions are not in many areas as powerful as they used to be, but I can guarantee you that if the tax cuts are removed, that will have an impact on wage demands. It will undoubtedly have an impact on behaviour more widely than just trade unions and trade union members. And so you'll get a knock-on adverse consequence there in inflationary pressures from wages, almost inevitably. The magnitude will be debatable, but almost inevitably. Fourthly, everybody who's putting forward this argument assumes that every last dollar that every citizen gets in a tax cut will be spent, not saved. That's a false assumption. The true position is that it's impossible to tell with any degree of precision, but it's a reasonable hypothesis that a proportion of the tax cuts will be dedicated to what you might call household balance sheet repair. So, in effect, saved rather than spent. So that's an important factor to bear in mind. But finally, and in my mind, most importantly, for better or for worse, if we as a government are saying to the community, we have got to make some tough decisions in order to get the inflation problem under control, we need to cut government spending, we expect you to exercise restraint, then that requires moral authority. And one thing I can tell you is that if we do take the advice that's being offered to us by some, then we won't have a great deal of moral authority left to persuade people that the kind of things that we need to do and that we hope they will do, and that they will actually accept those things. So that's almost in the realm of kind of psychology, but I think that's a very important thing, that we've made that commitment. People can debate the ins and outs of it, and the notwithstanding the fact that we all know some of the commentators and, you know, some degree of popular research, but it's by no means a simple debate. And we've made the judgment that the tax cuts in totality will not have an inflationary effect. To a degree, they involve giving back bracket creep as well. And that's what we intend to do. And I think some of the commentary on this has been a little bit simplistic.
Good question over here. Yeah?
Minister, the economic upset that Australia faces is inflation, and that's largely due to the oligopolistic nature of many of our industries. So to what extent will your deregulation efforts ensure that distribution channels are fragmented, thereby giving smaller innovative firms freer access and easier access to the market space, particularly with reference to financial services sector and the retail sector?
Just a very quick response.
Sorry. Look, I think there's no doubt that that assessment was to the inflation problem we had in the 1970s, that what you just said was absolutely central to the problem then. I think it's debatable the extent to which it's relevant now, particularly in the retail sector. And of course, we've established an inquiry into that whole question of retail prices to examine that question. So my own view is, and there are different views on this, obviously, but my own view is that notwithstanding the apparent concentration in retail in this country, my own view is that it's basically pretty competitive. And people, I think, get a kind of, it's not perfectly competitive, but I think it's pretty competitive. And people get, I think, a slightly distorted view. Financial services, Well, I think it's certainly a lot more competitive than it used to be. Recent developments, market-driven developments, the drying up of cheap credit overseas has probably undermined that degree of competition, but none of us knows whether that's a temporary phenomenon or whether there'll be a permanent phenomenon there. I think the question you raise is a legitimate one, because there's no question that in the 1970s, oligopolistic structures and government, excessive government intervention, you know, two airline policy kind of arrangements were a significant element in our inflation problem in the 1970s. I don't really think that's true now in a big picture sense, but there are probably instances around that would support your thesis, but whether in the overall scheme of things they add up to much as part of the overall problem, I think, is debatable. But it's a very important dimension to the argument, though. I think that question of market structure and degree of competition as a question about inflation, you're asking the right question. I'm not sure I'd agree with your answer, but you're asking the right question.
Thanks. Just stand there for a second. I'll be very brief. We've gone a fraction over time, so you got a lot of questions, and we could have gone on longer, so you don't have to. I appreciate apologies, but you don't have to answer. Look, it's good to hear a cabinet minister talking again about deregulation, and it's great that the minister has decided to give his first major address on deregulation to the Sydney Institute. It's an important paper. It'll be good when it's published in the Sydney papers, and thanks for a wide ranging address and dealing with so many questions. And we could have gone on longer, but we don't. So many thanks, and I hope you'll come back again. Thank you. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.